The following episode may contain explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis. We are cranking along once a week. This is your new day, guys. Wednesday. I know I floated this thing around back and forth, but I believe this is going to be the day. Wednesdays, 6 a.m. You can count on me. Now, I might have bonus. I might have extra, but you are going to get at least one from me. This is my commitment to you. Throwing my hat over the wall. Wednesdays, 6 a.m. You can do me a huge favor and spread the word to your friends. This is how we can grow this thing. Podcasts are always spread word of mouth. You live here. You like the show. You tell people that you like the show. Are you a football fan? Oh, I don't mean that kind of football. I mean the other football. The Atlanta United Championship. Can I get a rapping horn? Ladies and gentlemen, my feelings have been made very clear about the soccer, but I'm willing to be converted. As I've said, I'm willing to talk. So, do you know anybody that plays for the United, that works for the United, that is tangentially connected to the Atlanta United at all? I'd love to learn more. I'm sure now they're going to be really hard to get a hold of, but who knows? Congrats to Atlanta. You've united our city, even though I'm not quite there on the bandwagon yet. Speaking of bandwagons, the Falcons, ugh, where do we begin? So much talent. There's always next year. On today's program, Damon Korn. I think it's about time I reminded you of the tagline for this show, the Atlanta Podcast, where I talk to the famous, Atlanta famous, infamous, and anyone else I find interesting. Damon Korn is the latter. It will not take very long for you to figure out why. He is one of a kind. He's got a Southern accent, an undeniable Atlanta Southern accent, which I adore and I also make fun of. I might have made fun of it right to his face. I don't remember. But he's got some stories to tell. And I think pretty soon on, you'll see why I invited him on this program. And you'll be glad you listened. So here's me and Damon. By the way, RCR Studios, today's sponsor, RCR Studios, they make compelling content to get your brand's message across. There's a better phrase in there. I forgot what it is, Randall. I'm sorry. Randall and his team, they're amazing. I've been recording all the episodes there. You're going to notice, oh, wow, this sounds a little bit better than normal, Matt. Why is that? Oh, because I'm recording over at RCR. They're awesome. We're killing it over there. And you're going to hear us talking about 80 Avenue right over there. Sorry about that, Damon. There's my impression of you, buddy. All right. Away we go.
So let's start with, you just said you grew up right down the street?
Yeah, man. So my grandmother and my father lived, if you go to the end of Hamilton at 80 Avenue and make a right and go all the way to the end of 80, the last house on the left, yeah.
Wait, they're still there?
The house is still there. I rode by there on the way up here this morning. They tore the next door neighbor's house down and built one of those new big nice houses. This whole neighborhood's going to that.
And so what, can I ask what year that was?
Let's see. I moved there when I was 10 years old. So that would have been 1978, the end of it.
Woo! You were 10 in 1978. I was 6 in 1978, right?
Yep.
I think there's a lot of reverence now for the 70s and 80s, right? Because everything is always like. But what do you remember about being like a kid in like the late 70s, early 80s?
Well,
like what was life like for you? Were you an athlete? Were you outside?
Life for me was, I like to look at it as I had kind of a dual presence in my early childhood. I was born in the spring of 1968. My father back then was a 49-year-old union iron worker and a certified welder. He was also a heroin addict. My mother was a 32-year-old banquet waitress at the Hyatt Regency downtown. And she was basically just doing the best she could to raise five mean-ass little boys.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was the youngest.
Wait a minute. Hang on now. This explains a lot already. No girls, all boys.
Because
you know I got three kids. So five to me is mind-blowing, and I know my two boys like will kill each other any day, so oh my goodness.
Yeah, we were a rough crew. I was the youngest. I was my daddy's only son, and my mother, I was her fifth son, and my father was way older than my mother, so when I was about 3 years old, they divorced, but both of my parents had kind of like a country, they were both city dwellers, but they had like a country background, so I guess you could say like my socioeconomic status as well as much of my personality falls somewhere between ghetto and get her done, you know what I mean?
Wait a minute, did you write that?
Ghetto and get her done?
Ghetto and get her done.
That's real, dude, that's good. That's really good.
It describes it perfectly.
Right.
How I ended up over on Edie Avenue, though, my father, when I was 3 years old, he messed his arm up shooting some old bad Mexican heroin, and he got on methadone after that. And him and my mother divorced, but he moved in with my grandmother, and they lived on Cherokee right across from that police precinct then. Then she sold that big house, bought this house on Edie Avenue. My mother and my stepfather, we were living in Monticello, but that's a long story.
Hang on one second. First of all, was this a black neighborhood or a white neighborhood?
This was a white neighborhood.
This was?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, it was kind of mixed around, because I went to school right up here at a little elementary on Home Avenue. It ain't there no more, but it was called Jerome Jones Elementary. And we walked to school. There wasn't no buses. And back then, like I said, growing up, man, it's like I had two dual people, because on the one hand, I did a lot of the normal stuff that little kids do, boys club around here. I went to the Warren G boys club up here, and I went to school, but my daddy was always kind of a hustler on the side. Like I said, he quit shooting heroin, which kept him out of prison, but he still kind of hustled on the side, you know what I mean? And that's kind of where I learned that stuff from, you know, at an early age. And growing up, I kept that part of things a secret, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I wasn't one of them kids that went to school and said, my daddy's got a bunch of pills on the coffee table.
Right.
You know, I just wasn't one of them kind of kids. And so I kind of felt like, you know, how most of us recovering addicts and alcoholics got that sense of not belonging.
Right.
Feeling different.
Right.
Well, that's kind of where I was at. But
so wait a minute. If you were the hustler on the side, were you just like a night? You did good in school or you didn't do good in school?
I did good in school. Okay.
If they could make you go.
Right.
So you put on like the I'm a good kid face, and then you're like hustling on the side.
Well, man, my stuff started so early. I mean, it's unreal.
But that's why you're here, dude.
That's why I'm here. Okay. I'll give you a little bit of it. In 76, my mother and my stepfather decided they was going to pursue the American dream of providing for their kids a better life than they had, et cetera, et cetera. So we moved from Key Road. Now, my mother's back on Key Road. She's had that house over there for 60 years. She's still alive, 82 years old. But we moved to Monticello to get us off these mean old streets of Atlanta, you know what I mean? But it backfired, because in that little small town in Alcove Shores on Jackson Lake, the kids there, at least the ones I found, were trouble. I mean, big trouble.
Was it like suburbs, like farm?
It's not farms, it's lake houses.
Got it.
A lot of people come in the summer.
Right. So what lake?
Jackson Lake.
Which is?
45 minutes east of Atlanta.
East?
In Monticello, Georgia.
Okay, what else is that next to? I'm trying to...
Jasper County.
Okay.
If you head that way, Covington's maybe 10 miles.
Conyers?
Conyers is maybe 10 miles or more, 15.
Got it.
But when we moved there, we started going to school. I was in the third grade, and there was a couple of guys in my neighborhood that were older than me, that set the stage for me my whole life, hanging out with older people. And one of them... He was probably 4 or 5 years older than me, and the other one was probably maybe two or three years older than me, and that's when I started getting in trouble. I was 8 years old, and this is the 70s, remember? So back then, they had these window air conditions in everybody's house, and all these people had these summer houses, so this guy, David, I mean, he was the real deal juvenile delinquent, okay? He would break in these houses, and it didn't take him long to figure out. I was so small. I was a little bitty kid, man. He would shove me through those little vents
right
on the side of those window air conditions, and I'd go around and open the door, and then we'd rob the place, you know. And, you know, we'd take stuff like beer and liquor.
Sure.
And whatever you could find in these houses. And with that kind of behavior, it being a small town, it didn't take him long to figure out who was doing it.
Of course.
So the police started coming to my house. And
did you have like a bedroom full of stuff?
No, The one time they caught us with some actual stuff, we were up under the Waters Bridge drinking the beer. And Arthur Gordon, I won't never forget him, man. He was a sheriff down there. He come walking under that bridge and squatted down. We didn't see him. When we looked up, there he was. So David kicked one of them TVs off into the lake, took off running. Of course, he had us. So they take me home. Now, after that, they actually prosecuted David in the juvenile justice system.
Right.
After that, we weren't allowed to hang out with each other, but you know how that goes. We still snuck. So I'm going to fast forward just a little bit.
Can I back up a little bit?
Just a little bit.
Can I back? Let me ask you something. You said real deal juvenile, and I got the picture in my head of a kid that I hung out with that not even to the level you were at, but like we did some stuff, but like he was the bad kid, I wasn't. You know what I'm saying? Like he was the real deal, and I was just kind of hanging with him. You didn't see yourself that way?
At that point, I was so young, I didn't even know who I was.
It was just fun to be around this guy.
I looked up to him. I idolized him. Now, in retrospect, and even not that much longer, even in by my late teens, I figured out how them kind of guys are and the way it is. But, you know, at 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, he was like my hero. You know what I mean? But really, this dude here, he was what you call, he was a thief in his heart.
Right.
I mean, he could not steal something, you know. He ended up getting beat to death.
Oh, my God.
Later on in life over at the dam.
For taking stuff.
I don't know for what. I just know somebody walked up behind him, beat him to death. Nobody saw anything. He died. And that's the end of his story. But when I was about 11, we was deciding on one of our little better schemes. You know what I mean? So what I done is I told my mother that I was going to my daddy's for the weekend. I told my daddy I was going to stay at my mother's. And me and David had planned to sneak off to Monticello for the weekend. And it worked.
Because your mom and dad didn't ever call each other?
Not that much. I mean, they were on okay terms, but I mean, they didn't really communicate because my daddy was more like on my side. He was more like my buddy, my friend. He was older. He was kind of like, he just wasn't like the disciplinarian of the family. That was my mother. She did all the ass whoopings. Okay. And so we pulled it off and I went in there and I stole a bottle of my mama's nerve pills. Now, I guess after five boys, nerve pills would be on the agenda for somebody.
Would we know the clinical name for these drugs?
I couldn't even tell you myself, man. It's been so long ago. But David knew because he's the one who told me. He said, go in there and look around and find a bottle of pills, you know. And I took her pistol, too, while I had it, while I was
sure,
in there.
Sure, why not?
And we were coming down the highway heading toward Monticello. And, of course, Arthur Gordon rolls up.
The sheriff.
Yeah. When he seen us, he knew automatically that was larceny in motion. You know what I mean? So me and David takes off and runs to the woods. And Arthur stays up there at the street shining his light. And David tells him, he says, look, don't come out unless I come down here and tap you on the shoulder. If I call your name, don't matter. Unless I come down here and find you and tap you on the shoulder, you don't come out. And I laid there, man. And they've called my name. He went up there because he knew if he didn't come out, they'd be helicopters, I guess. I don't know. So he goes out, and Arthur Gordon takes him. They called my name for about 10 minutes, but I wasn't coming out because he didn't come down there and get me. So then here it is, dark. It's on this highway, man. There ain't even no lights down there on that highway, at least back in the 70s there wasn't. And I headed on back to the house, and I was messed up on them pills, you know what I mean? But I had sense enough every time a car jumped in a ditch. But anyway, I finally made it home. When I knocked on the door, I took them pills and that pistol and hit them outside. When I knocked on the door, by then, the whole world been looking for me. I mean, mm-hmm. They didn't know where I was at. There was like search teams. You know what I mean? This was a big deal. My mama took one look at me, took me to the hospital, had my stomach pumped out. And the next morning, I'm not sure. I guess the stress of all of it. I mean, she was probably 40, early 40s. I got up before she did, and I went outside, man, and I got that pistol, and I was in the bathroom floor playing with it when she opened the door. And I'm going to tell you the truth, man. She gave me one of those 1970 ass whoopings. I'm talking about one the culture of the day couldn't even accept it. It was even bad enough back then I was able to play that for all it's worth. So
what do you mean?
She put some little weps on my ass. You know what I mean?
Play it for all.
Bow! Whooping me.
Right. Can I back up real quick?
Yeah.
So your friend.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's, I don't know if sweet's the right word, that he looked out for you like that and said, listen, I'm going to go. Like, he took one for the team and told you, listen, don't, like, he had, like, he knew they were going to say, hey, call your friend out, but yeah. When I do, don't call me.
Right.
Like,
well, it sounds like that, but you got to look below the surface, see? It looks like that, but what he done is gave me them pills and that pistol and told me to lay there so we wouldn't get caught with them. You understand what I'm saying?
But he turned himself in, though, I thought.
Well, the guy seen us. There wasn't no denying who it was.
Right. So he didn't have the gun and pills on him.
Right. And plus, if I didn't come out, they didn't find no guns and no pills. There's what are no they going to do to
There's
him?
No crime.
What are they going to do to him? I mean, there's nothing they can do. I'm not sure what they did. Maybe they took him home. Maybe they took him. Who knows?
Right. But here's the good news for you is that it is 1978, because if it's now when they're waiting for you, then they bring you to jail. Now it's like whatever, it's small town, whatever. And
oh yeah, man. Back then it was a different ball game.
Right?
Right. It was back then you could do some stuff.
Right. And the sheriff would just be like, get on fucking home, kid.
Right.
Now they don't do that.
Well, I think what I've experienced with, especially with the juvenile justice system, because my story don't end there.
Well, I know it doesn't.
But they give you a lot of chances.
They do?
They give you a lot of breath. But the way it is now, I mean, they got to do something with, you know, because back then, yeah, I stole my mama's pistol, and yeah, I was walking down the highway with it. But today, some kid might take it to school.
Right.
And shoot the bully.
My kid brought a decorative bullet that I have. And by the way, we are, you know, my wife and I, we are a peaceful people. Right. There are no guns in our house.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
we are
neither.
We are probably anti-gun. But I had this little necklace with a bullet on it that's like a something somebody gave me. It's like a leadership thing. It's like a harmless 1942, whatever, a long, I don't even know the caliber.
Right.
But it's not, but Jackson brought it to school. So when they call me and they say, your son brought a bullet to school, I almost lost my mind because, and this is what I'd like to talk to you about some, and we're going to kind of jump all over the places. I've said this before. You've met my boy, Jackson. I don't think Jackson would rob a convenience store, but I think Jackson would be in the car while they're robbing the convenience store because his buddies were doing it. And then they all get busted. Yep. But anyway, so Jackson brings us. And so I think Jackson's got a fucking bullet from like a 9 from a kid in our neighborhood. And when they described it to me, I was like, I wanted to go, come on, y'all. Like, you can't tell the, but that's, it's 2018.
Right.
You can't even like say the word bullet at schools.
Right.
So thankfully he didn't get like suspended, but they sent him home for the day, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, just put in context the world of that stuff. But anyway, now I lost track of where we were.
Okay. So after the incident, that's how I ended up here on Edie Avenue. I called
they were like, you need to get him out of here.
I called my daddy and I called my grandmother and basically told them she's trying to beat me to death down here. You know what I mean? And so they used defects.
Right.
They come down there and took me to the social services and they granted my daddy temporary custody of me, and I moved to Atlanta up here on Edie Avenue. Now, that was probably the accelerant to my life of drugs and alcohol and all that kind of stuff, because when I moved in with my daddy and my grandmother lived about another year, and then she died in 79. My daddy, like I said, was always hustling on the side, selling pills, things like that, and that's where I got my introduction to the stuff. Along about 12 years old, he would say stuff like, so-and-so's going to come by here, and I want you to give them three of these. These would be like K4 Dilaudid or 50 or 100 milligram Demerol. And he'd say, they're going to give you a certain amount of money, and I'll be back. And I got a thrill from that. And plus, I learned that you could do it pretty easy. And that's how I got my start. Now, I kept all that hid, okay, because I knew better.
So you're going to school like a regular person?
I'm going to school when they can make me. I was bad about not going to school. And my daddy was bad about not making me, you know. And that's just how it was, you know. He was real easy with me, man. I could talk him into anything. I mean, literally. I could come up with some scheme or story and he'd bite it. And I don't think it was because, I used to think he didn't know no better, but I think it's just because he just couldn't say no to me. I mean, I was like his only child, born when he was 49, you know. It'd be like me having a child right now. I got a little grandbaby, and I promise you, he's 1 year old, and he can't do no wrong.
Of course.
Okay, he can't. Now, so far he hadn't, but I'm just saying.
Of course.
That's how my daddy felt about me. And so my mother left Jackson Lake, moved back up here off Key Road. So I started back and forth. And that is how, over off Moreland Avenue, Key Road's right by the Starlight Drive-In, man. And back then, this would be 80, 81. Again, I started hanging out with some older people. And this is how I got involved seriously with drugs. I hung out with some older, they were junkies. But they treated me like I was a child, you know? they would be shooting dope, and they'd make me sit on the back of the car. They'd make me go in the other room, and it was messing with me, man. I was pissed off. So I finally, one day, I told them, I said, listen, I can get more drugs than you can get. And they looked at me kind of funny, and back then, the big thing was pharmaceutical speed. You get it from the doctor. They call it diet pills, but it was pure amphetamine. Mm-hmm. I said, take me to my house, and they took me to my house, man. And I went in there, and my daddy kept a bottle of 15 milligram Dizoxin, purest amphetamine you can get on the planet, man. I reached in there, and I stole some of them. I went back out to them, and I showed them to them. We went to a basement over off Key Road, and they didn't make me sit on the back of the car no more. That night, I threw my arm out, and they stuck a needle in it. And I'm going to tell you something, man. It took me almost 30 years to recover from that. 30 years. I was 42 years old when I got clean and sober. Now, in between there, I done a lot of stuff. I mean, I did a lot of stuff. I spent 7 years in the Navy. I spent 10 years in the Georgia prison system. I've had more episodes of different. I mean, it's just unbelievable that I have made it out of that mess. I done my last drug on October the 10th of 2010. I just picked up 8 years in my recovery group. And if I could, of course, you know, but if it's hard to even describe the difference in my life today than it was just 8 years ago.
Well, I want to ask you the unanswerable question because, you know, I want to. When I was a young man, my drug of choice was Budweiser beer. It was cheap. It was available. I certainly smoked a lot of weed. I would try kind of whatever you had. But a friend of mine described doing heroin. A friend of mine I worked with at Pizza Hut described. And he talked about melting into the floor. And I was like, I'm fucking never touching that shit. Now, you and I know that there's this thing called Yetz, right? Maybe I would have gotten there had I stayed drinking the rest of my life. And I didn't get sober till, you know, 20 years ago, which was 10 years after that. But you wanted it, right? You were like, come on, man. And it, for me, it would scare the shit out of me. And that's sort of like the, like, who knows what makes a fucking addict? That's the kind of the unanswerable question, right?
Answerable.
It's like you went towards that. And I just heard about a guy describing something that seemed beyond my comprehension. And I thought, I'll never fucking stick a needle in my arm.
And I know people, you either do it or you don't. And that's what it boils down to. The people, I want to say, have a greater sense of what can destroy them. Stay away from that. And the people that are just ain't scared of anything, go towards it. My own life was influenced by older people. That desire to fit in, that desire to be some part of what they were, okay? It's so cunning and baffling, that lure to be a part of things. And I think that's what recovery gives us. Once we finally have had enough of that, hit that proverbial bottom, we become a part of something and people accept us for who we are. Like, I can't really believe I'm sitting here with this big-ass microphone in front of me telling stuff that's just incredibly just bad.
We haven't even scratched the surface with you, by the way.
But I do know that my greatest gift today is that tragedy.
Because
I take what I learned from my experiences and the fact that I have come up out of that sewer and help other people with it. I sponsor several guys in recovery, and they're a mix. I got one guy that's, now I would never call him by name, but I got one guy that's a data analyst for a Fortune 500 company, 20 years sober. I got one guy that's an Alabama redneck, likes to smoke crack. He's clean almost a year. I got another guy that's a lifelong bail bondsman guy, you know, just cool as can be, man, but finally had enough. And all of our stories are similar, even though the circumstances of them are different. When I share with them guys stuff like I'm talking about right now with you, they know I'm telling the truth. They know you can't make this shit up. They know that when I tell them, if I can get sober, you can get sober. They know that I'm telling them the facts, man. I ain't had an original thought my whole life, man. It's only because somebody done it for me. An old junkie out of College Point, New York. When I came into the program 8 years ago, man, he recognized me immediately. Never seen me before in my life. He said, you know what? If you'll get on your knees every morning and ask God for the strength not to stick that needle in your arm, but you got to mean it, he'll give it to you. And I went, oh my God, man, I've had doctors and preachers and I had a team of psychiatrists when I was a teenager. Mama went to work for General Motors. We had pretty good insurance, man. I had a whole team of them that told her when I was 13 years old, they said, ma'am, your son is going to do one of two things. He said he's either going to join the military, have a religious experience, or spend his life in prison. And it was the truth. I did join the military. I did have a religious experience, and I did spend a hell of a long time in prison. But I knew that when this guy told me that, man, and I seen it in his eyes, he wasn't lying. He's been sober now almost 20 years. I call him regularly, a good friend of mine, our sponsor, sponsors both of us. And I did it, man. And you better believe this morning before I come here, I was on my knee asking God for the strength to stay clean and sober today.
See, I thought you didn't have to mean it at first and it still worked. Because some people don't, right? Some people are like, well, I don't think this works. I don't believe in a thing, but I'm going to do it because my sponsor said to do it.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I was in and out for 5 years before I picked up the last white chip that worked.
Right.
You know, it's a process. I love that I go to meetings around Atlanta and I hit the Grant Park, East Atlanta, all this area over here. I love now that I'm seeing more and more young people getting sober. Man, I could have been anything I wanted to be if I would have just listened to somebody. But when I was 13, 14, 15, 18, 25, 30, you couldn't tell me anything, man. I had to learn every single lesson the hard way. I just couldn't learn it, man, because I thought that I knew more than everybody else. You know, I see a lot of times this stuff on Facebook. It says, if you could pick any person on the face of the earth and sit down and have a conversation with them, who would it be? I'd say, you know, I'd like to talk to my daddy. Because I thought, growing up, I mean, here I was 14 years old trying to tell him how to run a pill business. And he'd been doing it for 40 years. I'd like to just sit down and say, you know what? Everything you told me has come true. And I'll tell you this. I'm 50 years old today and I have never done a shot of heroin. And I'm going to tell you why. When my daddy started suspecting me of getting in his pills instead, I used to tell him I was selling them. But I think somewhere along the way, he figured out I wasn't selling as many as I was doing. It was all in them speed pills, amphetamine. He said, son, if you come home with a heroin habit, I'm going to go ahead and kill you because I don't want you to have to go through what I went through. And I believed him. And he wasn't really a great big scary kind of guy. But let me tell you something. He meant business. When he told somebody something, they knew he meant it, and I knew he meant it. And to this day, now, I've done every other thing there is, oxys, Demerol, all that kind of old stuff, but I never have touched a bag of heroin.
Well, what did you shoot in your arm?
Amphetamine, methamphetamine. Back then, it was pharmaceutical speed. We get it from the doctor.
Right.
You know, that's one of the things that puzzles me today. Back when, 81 and 82, there was the diet pill craze.
Right.
Now, that big pharma is big now, and they got all the politicians in their pocket, and that's how come they can keep this battle going. You know what I mean? But right. Let me tell you something. Back then, it became just like it is now, but it was epidemic. When I was 14 years old, I had every fat girl in my neighborhood going to the diet doctor and getting pills. If you were 18, I used to tell them, if you're 18 and can pinch an inch, I'm going to show you the doctor to go to, and I'd pay them. They'd go get me the pills. And you cook them down and shoot them. And it's just like methamphetamine is today, except it was pure because now the government's trying to shut the ingredients down.
Now, hang on a second. These poor girls, right, who got self-esteem issues are proudly saying...
They're going to the diet doctor, buddy. That's why it was such a craze.
Were you sweet to them?
No, I paid them $50.
No, but I'm saying, like, $100. Were you like, hey, I mean, you can't be like, hey, fatty, go to the doctor.
No, you'd be like... They know. Let me tell you something. There's nothing wrong.
Randall, are you listening to this, by the way?
There's nothing wrong. That's what the pharmaceutical companies preyed on. They preyed on these people with weight problems.
But I'm saying, were you like, I don't know, were you like a pimp? Were you like sweet to the girls? And
no, I'm telling you.
Did you think about pimping, by the way? You seem like you could kind of maybe pull that off.
Nah.
If any white guy could. I know white guys aren't necessarily known for pimping.
Well, you know what? Pimping was probably dead by the time I came along.
Really?
Yeah. They.
You don't think there's people pimping out there right now?
Yeah, but the real pimps was in the 60s and 70s, man. That's when crack came along, everybody with a crack rock became a pimp. You know what I mean? That's because they get these women strung out on drugs.
Gotcha.
You ain't got to have no game. All you got to have is some dope.
Right.
That's how that game's played.
Right.
You know, any old pimps you see, they'll tell you, man, pimping went out in the 70s. When crack cocaine came along in the early 80s.
It was over.
It was over. Any of these old girls you see out here walking the streets, they got issues besides needing money.
Right.
Okay. Now, you got some high class ones probably up. It's probably sleeping with the politicians and them kind of people. Now, they got... They're high-class call girls, they like to call themselves, escort services. But I'm talking about the girl walking down the street.
Right.
If you go to the corner of Cedar Grove and Moreland Avenue, that girl that's right there by that Wendy's all the time and that truck bar across the street, Southern Comfort, yeah, she's got issues beyond just needing a few dollars.
Right, of course. Okay?
So back to the thing, I would just tell these girls, man, and they were all older because they had to be older.
Right.
They, They'd go to the doctor. And a lot of them, what they figured out, they'd go for me one or two times, then they'd go for themselves.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, of course. You got them hooked, man.
Well, they got hooked on the money.
Right.
Yeah.
So I know you talked about before that the longest you got sober previously was because you were in prison for like 6 years.
Incarcerated. Yeah. I caught a 20-year sentence in 1998 for drug trafficking.
Trafficking, which is
carrying a whole bunch of dope.
Right.
And I had a few skirmishes before that, so my record looked bad. And I was coming out of Griffin with a quarter pound of methamphetamine, got pulled over. They busted me. I knew it was over. And I'm going to tell you something, man. With the weight of that sentence hanging over my head and the consequences, I knew I was fixing to get at least 20 years. I knew it. I was down in Henry County. Oh, my God.
What'd you get pulled over for?
The girls I had come get me, maybe a taillight or something like that. A minor traffic stop.
Right.
And then one of them, the one driving, when he pulled her to the back of the car, she started pointing at me.
Oh, you know, man. I mean?
And I jumped out and ran. What's funny, though, is I had an ounce of meth in my pocket, but there was 3 ounces behind the seat of the truck they didn't know about. They sat right there and waited on the police to come back. And he got them with the 3 ounces. Of course, I took it when we went to court. You know what I mean? They had to let them go. But they gave me a straight 20-year sentence. And something happened then. That's when I had my religious experience.
Can we back up a little bit?
Yeah.
Is it like in the movies, the judge bangs that gavel and says 20 years and you're just, your whole fucking life sinks?
Let me tell you something, man. I was in that courtroom. That old judge, I won't never forget him. His name was Hal Craig, out of Henry County, old country judge, man. That man looked at me and he said it just like this too, I promise you. He said, boy, you should have learned your lesson the first time around. I hereby sentence you to 20 years in the Georgia state prison system. Man, my old lawyer, she was a public defender, a woman. She looked over at me. She said, are you all right? I said, would you be all right? Look, man, I turned white as a ghost, man. That's a long time because that's 20 to serve. You don't know if you're going to do 1 year or 20 years. You don't know. I mean, it's up to the state of Georgia at that point. And I wound up doing 6 years and 8 months. And like I said, that's when I really surrendered for the first time. I mean, really. I mean, I remember laying in that county jail just fiending for some dope. And I remember praying, man, maybe for the first time in my life, and asking God just to relieve me of that obsession, man, to get high. And you know, he did. And I spent that whole time studying religion, going to AA, you know, but it's different in there. That first year you get inside a prison in recovery ain't like that first year you get out here. You got to fight for it out here. It's given to you in there. I mean, there's a guy in a tower with a high-powered rifle keeping you from going to the liquor store or the dope house. And there's drugs in prison. You hear people say it all the time, man, the drug prison. And there is, but if you're smart, you're going to stay away from that in prison. You know, there's three things you don't mess with in prison. That's drugs, gambling, and sex. You don't fool with them in prison, okay? Because it leads to trouble. So I did my time, man, and I really became a better person. And then I got out, and I basically sponsored myself when I got out. I mean, I found an old sponsor, but I wouldn't listen to him. And I started dating this girl that used methamphetamine. And I stayed clean through a lot of it. And then finally one day, man, when I went in, it was methamphetamine. When I come out, it was this stuff called ice. I had never seen it. And it's like way stronger, way more powerful than regular methamphetamine. And she was doing it, you know what I mean? And like her dope man would come over, and I'd be like, I'd go outside or go in another room, you know, whatever. And I never had seen that stuff, man. But I'm going to tell you what happened to me. I was cleaning out her garage one day, and I found some old insulin syringes. Somebody was a diabetic. And I seen them, but I didn't call nobody. I didn't tell nobody.
Right.
I didn't make her get rid of them. I just closed that cabinet drawer.
Right.
The next time her dope man came over there, I did just like I always do. I went outside and waited on everything to get done. When I went back in there, I told her, I said, let me see what that stuff looks like. She said, no, I don't want you to see that. I said, I just want to look and see what it was, man. She pulled that half a gram of ice out of her bra, and she seen a side of me then she had never seen before, because I snatched it out of her hand, grabbed them syringes. I went to the sink. She was hollering, no, Damon, you can't do that much. Let me tell you something. She was right. After seven, I was clean then, 7 years and some change. And it took me 5 years to get back from that one shot. It took me 5 years. Now, the state of Georgia broke me from selling the stuff. Let me tell you something. You could be my best friend. I've been knowing you since I was 12 years old. I wouldn't sell you no drugs. I quit selling. When that judge gave me that 20 years, I quit selling drugs. I promise you, I wouldn't sell none, but I was an addict. So I started doing it, and it took me 5 years, man. And I guess the only thing that saved me from going back to prison through all that was two things. Number one was the grace of God, and number two is I kept a job. Kept a job, man. I was an automotive technician. I worked for a company called Just Brakes for 8 years, and I was pretty good at my job.
Now, when you got out of prison, they still hired you because they figured a lot of ex-junkies become mechanics? I mean, it's hard to get a job sometimes, right, when you got a
record? Here's the thing about jobs.
Let me back up a little bit. We have a problem in this country around that, right?
Right.
Especially with black folks, right?
Right.
They get arrested, they get over-sentenced, now they're fucked, now they're in the system, now they can't get a job, now they can't. So anyway, that's what I'm kind of asking about. Like,
Here's the thing. I'm honest on the application.
Right.
I don't lie.
Right.
If the application, when I went to work for Just Brakes, the application asked me, and I put the truth.
Have you ever been arrested or, sorry, have you been convicted of a felony?
Right.
Right.
Now, the question's always this. Have you been convicted of a felony in the last 7 years? Most companies give you a break. If it ain't been 7 years, then you're good.
Right.
So you can answer the question honestly and say no.
Right.
Now, if they do a background check, they're going to run it on you.
Right.
And they're going to find this stuff. You got to start at the bottom. You come out of prison, you're not going to get a job being the CEO of any company.
Right.
Okay? You got to start at the bottom. I started at the bottom at Just Brakes. Okay? I started at the bottom and I worked my way up. Okay? And that's how it is. People that walk out, what happens to a lot of guys, man, when they come out of prison, they're caught up in that ego thing, you know? The deck's stacked against them anyway. So you're going to have to work twice as hard. But if you will, take whatever comes. You know, it might be McDonald's. It might be Tire Man. It Just Brakes to start out with. It might be whatever it is. But when you get in there, you do the best job you can, and you be absolutely honest in your work and your ethic. And people, in time, will give you chance, okay? I'm no longer with Just Brakes. They sold the company, went out. I bailed on them. I went to welding school here, I guess, 8 years ago. That was part of the reason that helped me get sober. Then I went to work for a steel fabrication company, and that's what I do now. And this company will give you a break, okay? But most of the guys that come out of prison, they still got all these issues. They still got all this baggage. And if they don't get involved in some kind of recovery program, if you got drugs and alcohol as a problem, or church. I go to church. I'm a deacon in the biggest Baptist church in Decatur. You believe that? I'm on the finance committee of the biggest Baptist church in Decatur. I hope they don't get mad. I'm going to say this. First Baptist church in Decatur. You come over there and see me any Sunday morning, I'm there. All right. But I've been there for a while. You know, I've been there 6 or 7 years. Them people know me. Okay. They know my past. They know who I was. And they know that the power of God changes people. Okay. There's no denying it, man. There's no denying. When they look at me, I go, yep, that's me. That was me, you know. But it takes time. So if any prisoner, ex-convicts listening to me out there today, let me just say, look, you got to start somewhere. You know, you got to start at the bottom and work your way up. But if you went to prison and you were a drug addict or an alcoholic, when you come out of prison, I don't care if you do 20 years, you're still a drug addict or an alcoholic, and you better find some help, you know.
Because your sobriety years, you said it's a little bit easier. They bring the meetings to you.
It would have worked if I would have wanted it to, but I wasn't willing to realize. Let me tell you a funny story, man. I told my first story when I got out of prison at a recovery meeting. So I met this girl on the MARTA bus, right? I'm kicking around town on the MARTA bus because I ain't had no license or no car. And me and her meet each other, and she's in recovery. I say, oh, I'm in recovery too, you know. And so she takes me to this. She said, so we made us a little date. We went to a recovery meeting.
Right.
And so we walk in the door. Nobody's ever seen me before because I ain't been there. I've been in chain gang. And she's like a member of the place. You know right. what I mean? So this old lady was sitting at the back. And it was one of them speaker meeting places. And so this old woman, me and her's good friends, and I love her to death, man. She says, who's your friend? She tells this girl.
By the way, you doing an impression of somebody with a southern accent is hilarious.
Oh, she's got a southern. She's from South Carolina.
But you know how strong your accent is, Damon?
People tell me that.
Okay.
All right. So she goes, who's your friend? I said, and the old girl says, this is Damon. She said, how long you been sober? I said, 7 years. Hey, look here. I had been sober almost right. 7 years. You right. know what I mean? But I didn't tell her.
I was
been
in the joint.
In prison, right? So I get up in the front and I'm telling this story. You should have seen it. When I got to the part where I only been out of prison just a little while, her mouth dropped open. You know what I mean?
Right.
But that group saved my life because I did relapse. Like I said, I had about 9 months out of prison when I relapsed, but I kept going back. You know, we like to say that in recovery, no matter how many, it ain't like you got to meet a certain standard, man. We scrape the bottom in recovery. No matter how many times you fail, man, we always tell them, keep coming back.
Right.
And I kept coming back, man. It took like I said, 5 years for it to finally snap. And I don't know to this day exactly what happened. It was just my part, my time in the process. When it finally, I call it a moment of clarity, you know, that's what I had, was a moment of clarity that if I don't do something to change my life is not going to change. And that's what I done.
I got to ask you, though, back to this thing about, you know, finding a power greater than yourself, as we say. So I have one. I call him God. I don't know what he looks like or is or isn't, but I know that I believe in something. But a lot of people, right, that we know say, hey, like, I don't, but I'll do this because you said it works, or the mountains or the ocean or nature, whatever. So what do you say when you work with guys and they're like, hey, man, I'm not with this God thing?
What I tell them is a power greater than yourself, especially in the beginning, might just be this group of people that you're going to meetings with that's been sober, that's doing the deal. Eventually, people will come to a concept of a higher power that they can live with. That's where I think a lot of times religion gets it wrong.
Right.
Religion try, and I mean, I take graduate classes over here at McAfee School of Theology, buddy. I'm there on Monday night. I'm studying theology at a higher education level, and I love it. I did it in prison, and I studied it. I've been studying it for the past 20 years, and I love it. But at the end of the day, God is God, and there's no prescription for it. We can't put him in a box. I go to the best Baptist church in Atlanta. That's FBC Decatur, the best Baptist church in Atlanta. That's a plug for them over there. But there's no monopoly on God, okay? Because whatever your concept is took the liquor bottle away from your lips. Whatever my concept is. And that's kind of where when I sponsor guys, I say, okay, the door of recovery is wide open. We're a big tent kind of place. We take every kind there is. We take the people nobody else wants, all right? And the reason we're able to do that is because there's freedom in finding that power greater than yourself, you know? And I choose to call my higher power God. I read all about him in the Bible, and I believe that's true. But that might not be true for anybody. I'm going to give you a funny story, and I'm not sure how close we are to closing, but I heard the tale one time of this seminar on the proper way to present God. So the guy stands up on the stage and he asks everybody, he says, what do you think's the proper way to present God? And there's this guy on the front row like this, waving his hands, looking like Horseshack off of Welcome Back, Carter. And the guy calls on him and he says, you just pick him up and stick it to him like you do penicillin, and it gets him well. And that sounded pretty good. Then this old man on the back row, he raised up his hand real slow-like, and the guy called on him. He said, yeah, but some people's allergic to penicillin. And that's the kind of way it is with God.
Right.
Religion has done so much good and so much harm that a lot of people, especially people that travel in the kind of circles that me and you travel in, maybe they've had bad experiences. So it's not good to try to give the framework for their introduction to God. The only thing we say is you're in trouble and you need help. And that help comes in the form of a higher power that might just simply be the group itself until you grow something.
I think we're good, man. What do you? I guess the next thing is, so you want to? What do you want to do? You want to just continue to study theology? Do you want to become some sort of? I don't know what you become.
Well, I'm doing it as just a learning experience. I'm not no preacher. I'm not no teacher.
You don't want to do those things?
I do those things, even now sometimes. But I don't claim any title. If my church calls on me to speak, I do. And it usually goes off pretty well. If they call on me to do something in groups, if I'm called on in my recovery groups, I do that. And I count it all as service, because service is what keeps me sober. I was a drug addict and an alcoholic so long that my whole being was wrapped up in selfishness. And so I'm learning, and I'm learning a lot of it from my sponsor, who tells me to think of ways you can be more of service. Even at my job, he's like, the ones that are really getting on your nerves, you think about, instead of them getting on your nerves, you think about how you can be more of service to them. And I just, you know, he's been sober 40-something years. I'm just like, really, dude? But it's the truth. And so I'm not aspiring to be anything as like a minister or any of that. I just want to do, you know, God's will, whatever that may be. I'm hoping this is. I'm hoping that I don't get in no trouble for telling all this kind of stuff about myself. On the way over here, I said, you know what? You did time for every crime you ever committed you was guilty of, and the rest of them, the statute of limitations done run out, so it don't matter.
So you're probably okay?
I'm probably okay.
Well, I asked you here because every time you open your mouth, I usually smile because you're honest, and it's usually funny, and there's probably like 10 stories you told that I was hoping you'd tell today, and you didn't, and that's fine, because A, we could do this again, and B, I think it went how it went, and I think it went great, and I think... if you're listening to this and this reached you in any way, send me a note and I'll pass it on to Damon, because I'm betting you're not a big social media guy.
I am not, man. I learned about my daughter is a PhD student at the University of Delaware, and I learned about Facebook. She's married to a Marine, and they travel all over the place, but I got on Facebook to communicate
just to
with
see
her.
Like her family, yeah. Pictures and stuff.
And so I'm on Facebook, and I get on like everybody else. I'm looking at Facebook, but I'm not a social media.
You're not on the Instagram?
Nah. I did get on Twitter a while back. Somebody at church is on Twitter that I listen to.
Yeah.
And so I did kind of get on that, but I'm on it, but I don't really, I didn't even know what a podcast was until maybe the last year or so. Somebody introduced me to one and I listened to it and I was like, man, that's some good stuff.
Right.
So, hey.
Who do you listen to any now?
I listen to you sometimes, you know, when I can think about it, or it pops up on my phone. It goes, Atlanta Podcast has a new podcast.
Right. But you should listen to those.
I know,
it's
man.
It's good stuff.
Good stuff.
Will you listen to this or will you be too embarrassed to?
Oh, I'm definitely going to listen to this.
Okay,
I'm going to see if I sound like a jerk.
Oh, no, it's because some people are like, I can't listen to myself or whatever, but.
Oh, yeah, I'll listen. I'll be, oh, my God, I can't believe I said that. But this stuff is good, man, and this is a way of being in service, because the stuff, you know, sometimes it's just entertaining. Sometimes it's, like, meaningful. Sometimes it's, like, a combination of all that. And that's where I'm learning that real power comes from, and that is the stories of real people, because we've all got a story.
Right.
Every single person, if they're breathing, has a story. And so this is one way of putting those stories out there.
Well, you know what's great? You know what the program's helped me get is that. So when I got sober, it was in L.A. I don't know if I told you this. You got to go? We're almost done.
You're good.
And I like to say everybody was a junkie. Not clearly, literally not everybody was. But I go in there and I'm this 27-year-old, relatively high-bottom drunk. I mean, your bottom is your bottom. So, but I love beer, and I mean, honestly, like, I think I've said this before, like, beer and, like, chicks, like, that was my thing. Like, that's what I'll chase till the death, right? That was my heroin. Another story for another time. But everybody's in there as an ex-rock and roll star junkie, and I literally thought, well, I don't belong in here. Like, I never put a needle in my arm. I famously said I didn't know white people smoked crack until I got sober and heard about people in meetings saying that. And my sponsor said that thing we always say, why don't you look for the similarities, not the differences, right?
Exactly.
And so with you, I can hear all these stories and still see myself, right?
Yeah.
Because I've learned to do that and know that I'm no better or greater than or worse than.
Right. And it's like an inside job, man. No matter what beat us down, we're the same on the inside. You know, you felt the same way I did. Okay. And that's why the solution appeals to us so much if we stay in it long enough to get a hold to it. A lot of people don't make it, man. A lot of people don't make it. But some do. And that's what keeps us going, the ones that do.
Told you. Told you we're going to enjoy old Damon. He's a great dude. So thanks, guys, so much for listening. As always, I've got lots of great stuff in the can, including if you saw my social channel the other day, if you saw my Instagram, I talked to one Blaz Elias, who is touring with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra that just came through town up in Duluth. Yep, I drove OTP, saw a show with my man Clayton. We'll talk about that later, maybe next week, maybe after that. But, as I said, please spread the word about this program. Tell a friend about the Atlanta Podcast. It's how we're going to grow this thing. One more thing I want you to have a look at, and that's Morning Gratitude. I started an Instagram account called morning.gratitude. It's very simple. Start your day with gratitude. Tough to have a crappy morning when you start your day with morning gratitude. You write down 10 things you are grateful for. You tag your city. You post that on Instagram, you tag morning.gratitude, and away we go. It's catching fire. We got people already checking in from all over the world, and it's something I'm super proud of to be a part of. So enjoy it, the Morning Gratitude. I love you. I miss you. I mean it. I have got to run.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress.
It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
Membership fees apply after free trial. Cancel any time.
Okay, so why do people love my Total Body Bar workouts? Because they work. My clients get an amazing workout and great results. I'm Andrew Rogers, professional dancer and trainer, and my Extend Bar classes are fun, only 30 minutes, and proven to help you get sculpted, lean, and strong. And right now, you can stream my Extend Bar classes for free on the Beachbody On Demand app. See how effective these workouts truly are. Start for free today at beachbody.com.